Members of the court, my name is Robert W. Turner, registration number 864, appearing on behalf of the claimant. Couple of preliminary matters. First of all, I owe the court and Mr. McCray an apology. The reference in my brief on pages 11 and 13 to the Perino case should actually be to the Qualmet case, which is cited at 961 Pacific 2nd 590. And it appears both in Mr. McCray's answer brief and also in my reply brief. And I apologize to the court for the reference to the Loprino case on page 11, and then the second reference on page 13 of my opening brief should be to the Qualmet case as opposed to the Perino case. The Perino case stands essentially for the proposition that there's a difference between determining compensability in a workers' compensation claim and determining causation of the physical impairment once the injured worker reaches maximum medical improvement. The second issue is recently I've sustained somewhat of an idiopathic hearing loss, and the doctors aren't quite sure what it is yet, and so if I have a hard time hearing one of your questions, I would beg your indulgence and perhaps ask it again if I indicate some confusion. This is a workers' compensation claim. It's under Senate Bill 218, passed in 1991, wherein we set up the structure, basically saying that for more certainty in the Workers' Compensation Act, we're going to have this medical determination as to permanent physical impairment upon maximum medical improvement. Ms. Oldenburg was placed at maximum medical improvement by our authorized treating physician after about 18 months of treatment. That treatment was compensated by the respondents. They filed a general admission of liability saying, we agree you got hurt on the job. And between February the 8th of 2006 and August the 7th of 2007, February 8th, 2005, August 8th, 2006. She had many, many treatment modalities to her cervical spine, her thoracic spine, her right shoulder, right carpal tunnel, and a right thoracic outlet syndrome. Dr. Keston's reports are before this panel, and he treated her consistently for all of those injuries up until he placed her at max medical improvement on August 7th of 2006. At that time, pursuant to 842.101.3.7, he used the AMA guides, third edition revised, and came up with a physical impairment rating. That physical impairment rating was 28% as a whole person. The respondents objected to that. They objected timely. And part of Dr. Keston's rating was a 15% shoulder injury converted to 9% as a whole person under the AMA guides. Under the AMA guides, the guides say that the shoulder is 60% of the body. So Dr. Keston evaluated the loss of range of motion of the right shoulder, made a determination that she had a 15% scheduled injury, converted that to 9%, and that was part of the 28%. The remainder of the 28% was for a 4% physical impairment under Table 53 of the AMA guides, and the remainder of it was for loss of range of motion of the neck.
Did he give any opinion about whether or not there was a medically based connection between the cervical spine complaint and the shoulder injury or shoulder pain?
Yeah, Your Honor, in my opening brief, I argued about the cervical spine. In my reply brief, I took the position, I think that's a question of fact. There were conflicting medical views, and my argument before you today is just on the shoulder injury, because I don't think there's any question that there's conflicting medical evidence. Dr. Morfin, his deposition, and Dr. Morfin, his reports of November 2 of 2007, and 2007?
2006.
2006, and January 29th of 2007, says that she had non-physiological reasons why the range of motion wasn't appropriate, and he went back to Table 53 of the AMA guides and said, I'm going to give you 4% of the cervical spine. Case law, Metro Moving and Storage versus Gossert, Qualmed, Loprino, all the litany of cases would indicate that that's a question of fact for the administrative law judge, and if there's substantial evidence upon which he can make that determination, I'm going to lose. And in this case, Dr. Morf in his deposition said the range of motion had to be thrown out. He tried it twice. There were non-physiological reasons why he would throw out the range of motion, and he limited her to the 4% Table 53 rating. What I'm here to talk about today.
And you're now accepting that. You're not challenging that anymore.
I am not challenging that, Judge.
You're in your briefs, you're not anymore. Okay.
That's correct.
Okay.
What I'm here about today is this issue of the right shoulder. Dr. Morf, in his deposition, indicates that he wasn't asked to examine it. He didn't examine it under the AMA guides. He didn't examine it under 842.101.3.7, which requires him to use the AMA guides. The AMA guides require, if you're going to look at it, that you have to evaluate it based upon loss of range of motion.
Counsel, your opponent's brief, he indicates that there was an examination of the shoulder. It says that there was strength testing, neurological examination, provocative maneuvers, visual examination, all essentially negative, showing no anatomic or physiological basis for evaluating the shoulder. How do you respond to that?
Well, Your Honor, that goes to the...
My question is, throughout your briefs, you say there was no examination
yes.
of the shoulder. And I gather what you really mean there was no range of motion testing of the shoulder.
That's correct. And the range of motion, the range of motion testing has to be done under the AMA guides because
even if there's no physiological or anatomical reason,
if it's a compensable injury, yes, Your Honor. If it's been determined to be compensable, then the issue becomes causation of the physical impairment, and the dime doctor can make a determination of causation of physical impairment, and I have to overcome that by clear and convincing evidence. But once they agree that the matter is compensable, once they've paid for the care and treatment of the physical problems that Dr. Keston took care of, including the right shoulder, then the question becomes, under the dime, maximum medical improvement and physical impairment. Now, I agree that the physical impairment component includes a causation review. But in Dr. Morf's deposition, if you look at folio, I think it's 323, or pages 313, 314 of the folio, I asked Dr. Morf if he examined it. He said, no, he did not examine it, because he wasn't asked to examine it. And if you look at folio 29 on the application for the Division Independent Medical Evaluation, what he was asked to examine was the cervical and thoracic spine. He wasn't asked to examine the right shoulder injury, and the examination that he did of the shoulders, he did bilaterally. If you look at his report of November 2nd, of 2006.
Well, Mr. Turner, what he said at 314 was that he can't comment on the shoulder range of motion, as Judge Nieto pointed out. I didn't examine it. But on page 323, he said, I don't think the mechanism of injury may have caused any shoulder discomfort. Isn't that a causation finding by the dying physician that's subject to reversal only by clear and convincing evidence?
If you go on page 323, Your Honor, at the end of that, he says, I don't know if the mechanism of injury necessarily caused this problem, and I wasn't asked to rate it. All right? And what he is doing as a dime doctor is rating the physical impairment and maximum medical improvement. He says very definitely he was not asked to rate the physical impairment that this lady had to her right shoulder. And then the question becomes, is reading Dr. Morse's report of November 2nd, reading his report of January 29th, and reading the deposition transcript of Dr. Morse, did the administrative law judge have substantial evidence to make a determination that this lady wasn't entitled to a physical impairment for her shoulder injury?
Excuse me for interrupting, Mr. Turner, but
sure.
I noticed that his testimony not only says I wasn't asked to rate it, but it follows up on a previous question that I put to you. He says, I didn't think the mechanism of injury may have necessarily caused any shoulder discomfort, and he didn't see any documented pathology.
The mechanism of injuries, Your Honor, goes to the compensable nature of the claim. All right. I mean, once she has the injury, if the other side thinks it's not compensable, then they have the right to contest that issue of compensability, goes in front of an administrative law judge, and I have to show by a preponderance of the evidence that the claim is compensable. Once it's made, a determination is made that the person is at max medical improvement, the question becomes, what physical impairment there is, and was that physical impairment caused by the injury? Dr. Morse never got to the issue of what physical impairment there is because he did not comply with 842.101.3.7. He didn't rate that physical impairment under the AMA guides and get to the issue of causation.
He did it back. He did it reverse. He found there was no causation, and therefore he didn't rate it. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well,
because he says he did. It seems
what he found, Your Honor, is no compensability, and that's not his role. His role is to make a determination of max medical improvement and physical impairment, if any, and then make a determination whether there's causation to that physical impairment. His role isn't to make a determination as to whether the injury was compensable in the first place under the dime process.
And your assertion is that the employer conceded that this was compensable because he had paid for prior treatment by her treating physician?
Well, they filed a general admission of liability in this case, Your Honor. They filed a general admission of liability, which is the mechanism upon which they either agree that it's compensable or not compensable.
Did that specifically agree that the shoulder injury was compensable, or was that just direct to the cervical spine injury?
It's a complete compensability of all those injuries that the treating physician says were causally related to the injury of February of 2005.
And where's that found in the record, this general admission of liability? Is it in the record before us?
Yes, it's in the record, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. Mr. McCray?
May it please the court, Bruce McCray appearing on behalf of the respondents, registration number 3894. Mr. Turner has described the medical impairment structure of the Workers' Compensation Act, where we have this concept of the Division Independent Medical Examiner. I'd like to start by saying when the respondents filed an admission of liability, they conceded that there was an on-the-job injury and that this woman required some medical attention. It wasn't a blanket concession to everything that the authorized treating physician treated over this course of treatment, 18 months of treatment. The respondents were not conceding that each and every one of those components necessarily related back to the industrial injury. But the respondents are obligated to provide medical benefits and indemnity benefits if there's lost time until the authorized treating physician places a person at maximum medical improvement. And that's what happened in this case when Dr. Keston put the claimant at MMI.
And how are we supposed to understand the scope of the respondent's concession of compensability? Is it clear from the record from the submission that, Mr. Turner cited to that you're only agreeing to compensability for treatment but not for compensation?
The general admission of liability indicates that we admit for medical benefits and we're conceding that the claimant sustained an injury arising out of and in the course of her employment. But it doesn't lay out each and every diagnosis. In fact, it was well into the treatment by Dr. Keston that he identified right thoracic outlet syndrome, that he specifically identified a right shoulder injury. That came much, much later, but he was still treating her for some of the components of the injury that were indeed compensable, and the respondents were required to continue to pay benefits. But the point is, after MMI, the respondents requested a division IME, which they had the right to do under the statute. And when the division independent medical examiner examines the injured worker, that person has in front of him the entire medical records package. So he had the records from Dr. Keston. He had the records from Dr. Brian Beatty, who did an IME on behalf of the respondents. He had all of the physical therapy records, all of that information. We can't just look at what Dr. Keston was saying in a vacuum and compare Dr. Morphy's assessment to that. And when the division independent medical examiner examines the injured worker, he is looking for MMI and impairment, but incumbent in that process, as part of that process, he has to determine, make a determination as to what components of the injured worker's condition relate back to this industrial injury.
Are caused by it.
Absolutely. And that's what I mean by relating back, are caused by. And in this case, Dr. Morphy concluded that this woman did not have a specific injury to her right shoulder.
Caused by an industrial injury.
Correct.
And that causation determination is binding unless it's overturned by clear and convincing evidence, according to the case law.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
And that's why that's your understanding why he didn't do the range of motion testing on her shoulder, because he determined it wasn't caused by an industrial injury.
Absolutely.
And as I understand the record, Mr. McCray, there is no documented pathology for the shoulder in the medical records.
Correct, Your Honor, and I've noticed that the court has pointed out the statement that was made by Dr. Morphy in his deposition. I didn't see any documented pathology. I didn't think that the mechanism of the injury may necessarily cause any shoulder discomfort. So we've got a definitive statement by the doctor, and I will also point out that while the doctor said in his deposition testimony that he wasn't specifically asked to examine the shoulder, it is part and parcel of the DIME examiner's duties to look at the claimant's physical condition, all components of that, and make an assessment as to which components of that physical condition are caused by the admitted on-the-job injury. And in this case, Dr. Morphy concluded that there was no component that was not did not relate back. It wasn't caused by. And he does point out, as you have identified, he does point out in his narrative report where he did many, as part of his physical examination, he looked at strength testing for the bilateral upper extremities, neurologic examination, bilateral upper extremities, provocative maneuvers, bilateral upper extremities, specifically the shoulder, appearance of skin, he looks at the bilateral upper extremities. So he did, as part of his examination, physical examination, look at that. He also references the fact that he looked at the medical records package, which included the record from Dr. Brian Beatty. And Dr. Beatty had concluded, and he specifically examined the shoulder and, in fact, did range of motion testing of the shoulder. And then Dr. Beatty concluded that there were no objective findings to support any impairment. His diagnosis, myofascial pain syndrome, pain behavior which may represent factitious disorder versus somatoform pain disorder versus malingering. And we've got a somewhat similar diagnosis by the doctor. by the Division Independent Medical Examiner. Now, the Workers' Compensation Act states that impairment rating should only be given when specific diagnosis and objective pathology can be identified. And that's that comes from CRS 8-42-107, paren 8, paren lowercase c. It also comes from the impairment rating tips that are promulgated by the Division of Workers' Compensation. So we get back to the point here is that Dr. Morphy found no objective pathology to support any injury to the shoulder. Once he made that determination that there was no causal connection there between what happened on the date of injury and what he was assessing at the time of his Division Independent Medical Examination, there was no need for him to go further and do range of motion testing. He had concluded that there was no shoulder injury.
Let me ask you a question, just for my own edification. His report said no excessive pain, this is the November 2nd report, no excessive pain is noted with any TINELS, T-I-N-E-L apostrophe S maneuvers throughout her shoulders or upper extremities. Do you happen to know what TINEL maneuvers are actually intended to test for?
Your Honor, I wish I had researched that point before I came here this afternoon.
No, I won't press it.
I've seen that referenced on a number of occasions, and I can't tell you exactly the physical maneuver that the examiner puts the injured worker through.
I ask because it seems to state very clearly that he looked at her shoulder, he examined her shoulder, and contrary to what Mr. Turner said.
Yes, Your Honor.
Just that he didn't do range of motion testing.
Right. I believe he definitely looked at the shoulder, but once he concluded that there was no causal relatedness, he did not go beyond that and do range of motion testing.
Now, Mr. Turner seems to suggest that the AMA guidelines require range of motion testing. Is it your position that they do not, that he's wrong in that statement?
Well, my position is that they do not require range of motion testing unless the division examiner has made the initial determination that there is a causal relationship between this particular component of the claimant's presentation and the industrial injury. So once the examiner satisfies himself or herself that there's no causal relationship, then there's no need to go beyond that and provide an impairment rating. And I would also say that a point that Mr. Turner spoke to was this difference between compensability and causation. And I would go back to my point that when we file the admission of liability, when respondents file the admission of liability, we're just conceding that the person sustained an injury in the course and scope of employment. We're not saying that everything that a treater might treat that person for becomes part of this compensable injury. The division examiner, that person's job is to determine which components are compensable, and once that preliminary determination is made, the examiner will go on to do full range of motion testing and any other tests that need to be done to determine the extent of that person's impairment.
So help us a little more here. This admission of a conceding injury that Mr. Turner says in the record was also referenced in his brief, but there was no record citation given, as I think your opposing brief points out, so I have not had a chance to find it or look for it. Is it a statutory matter that conceding the injury doesn't necessarily relate to compensability, or is it the language of that concession itself?
Your Honor, the statutory language just says if the person is injured in the course and scope of employment, an admission of liability is filed. There is case law, and unfortunately I don't have a citation for you, but there is case law to the effect that just because the respondents file a general admission of liability, that doesn't mean that at any point in time they can't contest a particular component of the injury that is being treated. They can always do that. But here the important thing is we're to the point now where the ATP is given, MMI and an impairment rating, then it goes to a dime. The real question that we have before us today is, was there sufficient evidence in the records to support Judge Friend and later ICAO's affirmation of Judge Friend's order that claimant had failed to sustain her burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that the Division Independent Medical Examiner was wrong. I mean, what it boils down to is we have a difference of opinion between Dr. Keston, who says that there was a specific injury to the right shoulder, and the Division Independent Medical Examiner, who says there is no pathology, and I don't think it's consistent with the mechanism of the injury. And just because you have a difference of opinion, that does not, the claimant does not meet her burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that the Division Examiner is wrong. So I would respectfully request that the court affirm the Industrial Claim Appeals Office upholding or affirmation of the Administrative Law Judge's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCrary. Thank you, Mr. Turner. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. That completes our docket for today.
Turner, I think I had it done.
Oh, did you? I'm sorry.
Okay.
I thought you had exhausted your time, but I see here you do have a minute and 23 seconds. I'm very sorry.
That's quite all right.
First of all, Mr. McCrary indicated that the respondents have the right to not pay for something or not agree that something is compensable. In this record, they paid for all the care and treatment for the right shoulder injury. They never contested the issue as to whether or not the right shoulder injury was a portion of this claim. Never, ever. And what I'm asking this court for is direct.
Counsel, but didn't they ask for an independent medical examination which did challenge that?
No.
They didn't do an
They asked for an independent medical evaluation of the cervical and thoracic spine.
Oh, that was the DIME.
Yes.
Don't they have an IME report as well?
They had an IME of Dr. Beatty in May of 2006.
Doesn't that challenge the finding of the right shoulder injury?
No, Your Honor, because it was 4 months before max medical improvement, and B, they never contested the payment of any of the medical bills for the right shoulder injury. I mean, they sent him out to Dr. Beatty for an independent medical evaluation. If you look at Dr. Beatty's report, there's no indication it was done under the AMA guides. They had him see. But my point is, what I want from this court is a direction as to whether or not when you ask for a dime and you ask for a specific review of a cervical and thoracic spine, whether the dime is supposed to review everything, or are they supposed to just review what's asked for? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Turner.
Thanks.
As I said, the matter has been submitted. Finally, you can expect a written opinion to issue. Having considered your worthy rebuttal, Mr. Turner. That completes our docket, and the bailiff may announce a recess.